Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Slowing the rate of climate change will require us to reduce our use of fossil fuels and make the transition to renewable sources of electricity. One of the biggest changes will be the transition to electric transportation, cars, buses, trucks, boats, and even planes. And it's not as simple as swapping out fossil fuel engines for electric motors. We'll have to invest in smart design, charging infrastructure, and train a workforce to build, install, and service all of it. Today, we discuss next steps in making electric transportation a reality in our region. We start with a quick overview of the Cape Cod Blue Economy Foundation's second annual Big Blue Conference. This year, the focus is the future of electric. Joining us is Katie Atchison. She's Economic Development Director at the Cape Cod Chamber. Welcome, Katie.
Thank you so much, Mindy. Thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about the Blue Economy Foundation.
Certainly. So the foundation's relatively new. It was founded in 2017 by the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce. It underwent some projects that were funded by large federal grants, and then, of course, a pandemic. And the folks that were working on those initiatives and those projects moved on to other areas, other states. I think Bert went to Hawaii, so they're dispersed a little bit. So I came to the Cape Cod Chamber and adopted the Blue Economy Foundation, and with Paul's support, have started to reinvigorate some of the programs that were really successful, like our Waterworks Career Day exploration that we have at the community college for high school students. And one of the things we wanted to do was really bolster the regional identity as Blue Economy, so that our businesses have a unifying sort of driver, a community. You hear agricultural community, you hear industrial community. We're a Blue Economy community on Cape Cod and the islands. So to do that, we decided to create this conference where we can highlight the scope of what it means to be part of the Blue Economy on Cape Cod.
So tell us about some of the, you mentioned one, tell us about some of the programs or projects and educational opportunities that are offered through the Blue Economy Foundation.
Certainly. So the foundation is, for anyone that doesn't know already, blue as in water, right? We've got a lot of that going on around here. And so the mission of Blue Economy is to grow our economy in a sustainable and balanced way that focuses on protecting and promoting our water and our coastal resources. And so the scope of it is really grand. And what I've been able to do over the last year and a half is to grow connections to other blue economies across the region, beyond the state even. And so some of the learning that we're doing is actually internal right now. So we're working on, and I am working on, learning and understanding what a Blue Economy Foundation like ours is capable of. The Waterworks program has been the most successful, I'd say. The Blue Economies Conference, the Big Blue Conference, another success. I think we'll have everyone weigh in a week from now how it's going so far when we kick off. But one of the things we're working on now is building those relationships with other blue economies and other people doing the work so that we can start to advocate on behalf of our businesses, so that we can start to bring business voices together, much like the Chamber of Commerce does, across lots of different industries and needs for businesses. We become a unifying voice. We haven't been able to do that yet. So that's what our main mission is. Other projects that the Blue Economy Foundation has undergone, because we're our chamber's 501c3, we have some workforce development initiatives like our commercial driver's license program. We are working with businesses that rely on J-1 visa holders, and we're working with small businesses through Entrepreneur Forever program. So there's some business developments and workforce developments and advocacy pieces.
You mentioned other areas that are focusing on the blue economy. Are there many? Or is it just
there
a handful?
More and more. Yeah. So it's a relatively new term. Blue economy was coined in 2012 at a UN climate conference. So in this grand scheme of things, it's a relatively new sort of identity. But yeah, absolutely. There are this franchise model called Ocean Clusters out of Iceland. We have one in Portland, Maine. There's one in New Bedford. Those are heavily blue economy businesses where they're almost like co-working spaces, but they're also technology hubs for entrepreneurs. Mass Tech and MITRE are both heavily invested in research and development of aqua robotics, marine robotics. Our neighbors over in Plymouth have a conference called Blue Futures, where they do a similar conference to ours. In fact, I stole our whole sort of layout for it from my friend Steve at the Plymouth Foundation. And then we're talking about the New England Aquarium, IFA. These are national, internationally recognized organizations that work in blue economy. And also, the obvious ones, right? So the coast across the West Coast in California, Japan, everywhere where they've got fjords and offshore and hydro wind and water power. So yeah, blue economy is definitely global and it's definitely growing.
Sounds like a lot of brain power there, right? So
Oh,
give us a quick
it's so
overview
exciting.
of the upcoming Blue Economy Conference.
Certainly. So it's next week, Tuesday, April 30th, from 10 to 4, followed by from 5:30 to 7:30, a networking expo and robotics competition, high school and middle school robotics, which is very fun. So excited we get to highlight those students. And then Wednesday, our second day, we've got an 8 o'clock breakfast, then we go until about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So it's a lot. We've got about 25 speakers packed into those 2 days.
All right. We'll post a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Katie Atchison, thanks so much for being with us and giving us that update. We
Oh, my
appreciate that.
pleasure. Thank you so much.
We can no longer say electric is our future because the future is here. But as more of us transition to renewable electricity to power our lives, we need to be prepared. Fortunately, bright minds are thinking ahead and planning for that transition. Joining us is Dan Wolf, founder and board chair of Cape Air. Hi, Dan.
Good morning, Mindy. How are you?
Great. Stephen Tupper, deputy director of the Cape Cod Commission. Hi, Stephen.
Good morning, Mindy.
And Paul Nosewicki, CEO of the Cape Cod Chamber. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Mindy.
All right, so let's start really big picture with the electric grid. As we move away from fossil fuels and to electricity to power all aspects of our lives, there will be more reliance on the electric grid. So, Stephen, let's start with you. Are we going to need updates to the grid that feeds the Cape and then the power lines and stations throughout the region to prepare for this increased electric demand?
We certainly will need upgrades to the grid, and those are activities that are ongoing, and certainly things that have happened over many decades. So the electric grid, in many senses, is responsive to the needs, both on the inputs and the demands for electricity. So as we're seeing transitions to electrification of the transportation system, as we're seeing heat pumps, and then on the generation side, as we're seeing more solar and wind power, those certainly put pressures on our grid. But it's really the job of the operators of that grid to respond to those changes and make the investments that are necessary. So certainly this is a normal progression of infrastructure where you have a changing society and then the grid responds to it.
Anybody want to add anything to that? No? Okay. Several large offshore wind farms are set to come online in the next few years. Plus, we're seeing more rooftop solar and solar farms. How is all of this renewable energy being factored into the electric grid infrastructure and the ability of the grid to meet the future demand? Anybody?
I think it's a challenge. And I think it's the big challenge that we're in the process of sort of, years and years of educating people about electric vehicles, about the need to decarbonize the grid and offshore wind and a lot of federal subsidies to go in that. But none of it really works if we don't modernize the grid. The demand is going to increase substantially, and the grid needs to become more of a two-way street than the one-way street that it is now. And I think those challenges are real. A very significant.
It needs to be met from the top down, from a very macro planning perspective, but also from the bottom up. Like, what are the real local and specific granular distributive needs? An example, Mindy, is what's going on at the Cape Cod Gateway Airport under Katie Service's leadership. They're developing a microgrid there that does a couple of things. It better integrates in all of the solar that's being produced at the airport. But it also is looking ahead at the needs, let's say, for electric aircraft and other users in the airport, whether it be automobiles or the RTA, that are going to require that upgrade in the electric grid. So we're looking at it at a micro-specific grid issue, but also from a macro-specific ISO New England on down. So as Steve said, this is a huge planning effort, and it also requires great integration between the public sector and the private sector, both from a planning and implementation perspective.
Yeah. I'm just thinking, okay, as we're upgrading, does that costs money, right? And that gets passed on to consumers. We already have high electric rates.
So
We
certainly
do.
the Certainly the ability to afford these improvements is really important to the residents of the Cape. We do know some of this is being subsidized by grants at the federal and state level, so we certainly want to be opportunistic in terms of going after those grants. And we also want to be smart about these investments. So some of the things that Paul and Dan mentioned are really innovative strategies. So if we're taking the effort to rebuild this infrastructure, let's do it in a way that's smart and affordable to the residents.
Yeah, I would say for a long time, you know, we've been told that we pay the highest electric rates, some of the highest electric rates in the country, because we're at the end of the pipeline. But with offshore wind coming on board now, we're going to be at the beginning of the pipeline. And so we hope that some of these grid modernization efforts will sort of at least equalize the cost as it relates to residents of Cape Cod.
Yeah. Dan, did you want to add something?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, you're hearing a lot from the environmental justice community as well. And one of the things we have to be really careful about as we sort of figure out how we're going to pay for this, we have to make sure we do it in a way that doesn't disproportionately affect low and moderate income households on the Cape. Right. So I think, you know, there needs to be a smart conversation about whether some of the funding to do this comes from the general fund, whether we look at other, I think I would say, fairer ways to fund the future of electric production and distribution.
Yeah. Right now, much of the electricity we consume is generated by natural gas. And as we mentioned, New England has some of the highest electric rates in the country. Do you think the high electric rates are slowing consumer transition to electric cars?
So I that's do. Certainly one of the factors. Do you want to start, Paul?
I would just say if you look at sort of the cost of electricity to power electric vehicles and the cost of gasoline, there's not enough of a financial incentive as it's structured today.
Mm-hmm. And Mindy, as far as aircraft are concerned, just as an example, a lot of the models, we've been talking about this for almost 10 years in aviation, and a lot of the models that we've seen from the manufacturers of electric airplanes, which hopefully will come online in the next few years, build in an electric rate of maybe 7 or 8 cents a kilowatt hour. Well, when we're paying 30 cents a kilowatt hour, the economics of it don't work at 30 cents a kilowatt hour, because a lot of the capital cost of the equipment, which is really expensive, is supposed to be paid for over time by a lower energy cost. If that actually doesn't happen, then we have a real conundrum relative to how we're going to pay for this equipment.
We're talking about electric transportation this hour. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation or you have a question. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're discussing next steps in making electric transportation a reality in our region. With us is Dan Wolf, founder and board chair of Cape Air, Stephen Tupper, deputy director of the Cape Cod Commission, and Paul Nizwicki, CEO of the Cape Cod Chamber. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Many people have already made the switch to electric vehicles, and if you live here, perhaps you've installed a rapid charger at your home. But if we're going to be set up for visitors with EVs, we're going to need a lot more charging infrastructure. So how are local towns and agencies working to develop more charging stations?
Happy to start off here, and I do want to make the first point that the vast majority of charging does happen at home. So when we talk about infrastructure investment, most of it happens at home, but certainly visitors to our region don't have that home base. So we know that there's a role for towns and a role for the private sector as well in developing the charging infrastructure for visitors. Certainly, we've seen a lot of good examples of Cape towns taking leadership roles in this, where they have opportunities to install it on public sites. Cape Cod RTA had a number of their locations as well. We also know the business community has a role in meeting the demand of visitors, really, as an amenity that's being much sought after by visitors. I know we've been working with the Chamber on some hotel-specific projects, and we're looking at businesses as well.
So does this require, you know, the work of planning with zoning boards? I mean, you know, is there any special zoning issues that you have to look at with this?
I think it starts by being smart in terms of when you're making changes to a site. Some of the things that we want to see for infrastructure need to happen now, and some will be happening in the future. But the opportunity is to make the investments when you're making a change to a site. So if you're redoing a parking lot, there should be conduit run, and you should be sizing the panels to make sure that they're ready for that in the future. And that's something that should be reviewed anytime there's a major modification to a site. On the zoning side of it, there are some nuances in terms of actually permitting planning and the installations. We haven't seen huge barriers to that yet, but in some locations you have to think about ADA accommodations and some other nuances with the site design. But for the most part, that hasn't been the largest barrier.
You mentioned something. What are some of the key places that it makes sense to have the charging stations? You mentioned parking lots, hotels, beaches. Well, what are we looking at?
Well, you know, I think there are a variety of areas that we're looking at to support at least the tourism economy in the summer. Steve mentioned that the chamber and the commission are working on an effort right now to locate EV charging stations at hotels. A lot of the towns are making efforts. A lot of the beaches are town-owned. I think even as part of compliance with the commission's climate action plan, we'll see more efforts put in that direction. But there's more that we can do, too. Last summer was really the second summer in a row that we started to get more emails at the chamber from visitors complaining that there weren't enough EV charging stations. And that's a real concern. If you're coming to the Cape, say staying in Falmouth with your family, and you want to take a day trip to Provincetown, you're going to need to stop and recharge somewhere as it is now. But it's not, I think a lot of people think it's just about replacing gas stations, and it's actually not that. It's the opposite. You know, a lot of this will be happening at home. So there are opportunities for towns to maybe consider as part of their short-term rental compliance, mandating that those homes that are rented have to have at least a level 2 charger available. So there are some innovative ways that we can move here, but we can actually start to spark economic development by locating these EV charging stations closer to main streets, because people are going to need some time to recharge. And if they can get out and walk around, have a Cape Cod experience, and add to the economy while they're charging their car, then that's a win-win situation.
Yeah. I was just thinking, you know, if you're coming here and you're going to rent someplace and they go, hey, we have a charger, that's an attractive thing, right? That's one of the things you want to put on your checklist when they have, like, the filters, what you want, right?
It is.
And Mindy, not all chargers are equal. I mean, the way to reverse engineer this is to look at where cars are sitting and for how long. Mm-hmm. And if, you know, the cars are sitting in a parking lot at a marketplace, for example, for 30 minutes, a level 1 or level 2 charger doesn't do it, because in 30 minutes you don't get enough. So, but on the other hand, if cars are sitting places overnight, a level 2 is exactly fine. So part of the planning that has to go on is where are cars actually sitting for how long, and then how do we actually intervene at that point and get energy into them.
All right, so Dan, you're bringing up a good point. For those who don't have an electric vehicle, talk a little bit about how they work, and then who pays for the installation and maintenance of charging stations?
Steve, that's you.
Absolutely. So there's a variety of models in terms of charging. We've certainly seen businesses take the initiative to install them, understanding the return on an investment for them. So basically, if you have a place where people are going to want it to be for an extended time, that's a good place where a business may want to attract patronage by installing the charger themselves. They often are able to access grant funding to make those installations. When it comes to the more public-facing infrastructure, we've seen the state step up and put some new chargers, most recently at the park and ride off of Route 6 at 132. So that was a publicly financed installation, and that was really for the quick charge. Someone needs to stop off and top off. But more common, we see them installed by towns in places where they would like to see more activity. Like Paul mentioned, some of those downtown areas where you want people to park their car for an hour or two and explore the downtown. And that's where we've seen towns go after a lot of state grants to fund those installations, often working with charger companies who can manage, maintain those installations. So that's really the town is bringing that amenity, but it's the company that maintains and handles the payment and all of that on the back end.
We have an email from Holly who says, Eversource has time of use rates in other parts of Massachusetts, but not here on the Cape. Could this be offered here? It would make a big difference in the cost of home charging my car.
Could it be? Yes. And should it be? Yes. That's certainly a best practice in terms of encouraging this transition, is to make sure that you're most efficiently using the grid. And that is the way to do that, or one of the ways to do that, is time of use charge.
Just to add on to what Steve said before about the chargers, you know, level 2 charger, most homes, given the capacity of the electric systems at those homes, can accommodate a level 2. Not all, because level 2 is generally used between 40 and 50 amps on the high end. But if you go to a rapid charger, a fast charge technology, it really requires a much more significant infrastructure, because to charge a car in 20 or 30 minutes versus 2 or 3 hours or 4 hours, it just requires, and the expenses are very different depending on what it is we're talking about putting in. But to Steve's point, if we're looking at places where people are purchasing, you know, maybe we'll be parked for 20 or 30 minutes, the rapid charge technology is going to be a much better fit there. Mm-hmm. Whereas level twos or even less, aggressive charging can be done where cars are parked overnight. So it doesn't require a ton of granular analysis, but it does require that we actually look at what fits in any given location and make sure we're putting the appropriate infrastructure in.
Right. Another question, is there a universal charging hookup as opposed to each car manufacturer having their own system?
That's been an interesting story to follow over the last couple of years. There's a lot more commonality now than there was just a few years ago. So there's been historically a couple camps of chargers. It's been Tesla and everyone else for the most part. But there's been recent announcements by every major automaker in North America transitioning over to the plug that Tesla uses, the North American Charging Standard. So we're starting to see a lot more standardization, and really to deal with the interim where there's a few different plug types out there. There are adapters being shipped out. Some companies like Ford are proactively shipping them out. Others can purchase adapters. So what I would say is that the EV transition is a long game here, and we're going through some bumps right now, but a lot of those things are settling out and will become a lot easier in the coming years.
And maybe there's a hardware and a software component to that, because the hardware, we absolutely can adapt the plugs. And in fact, you know, I have an EV vehicle and I have adapters for all the different technologies. The issue is really the interface with how do you charge the customer. Mm-hmm. And really, we need to get to a point where if somebody charges their plugs their car in anywhere, it automatically bills the person. Mm-hmm. And we're not quite there yet. So a Tesla charging station, they're great from a technology standpoint and a hardware standpoint, but you can't plug into a Tesla charging station because it won't recognize your car and it won't give you the juice because it has no way to bill you. So I think you know, that's another hurdle we have to get over. Pretty easy to fix, but we got to get there.
Yeah. So how do you keep people from staying at a parking space with a charger even after the charge is complete? Does this, you know, require some kind of monitoring?
You charge them $1 a minute for every minute they sit there and they're not charging. That's how you do it.
And all kidding aside, that's exactly the model that high demand parking spaces will use. They'll disincentivize you parking there beyond the time you need to charge, so you can get turnover at those spaces. So we certainly see that in high demand locations.
Yeah, I do not have an electric vehicle, but I can tell you when I've gone on the Mass Pike and you stop at some of those rest areas, there's always a car where the electric chargers are, right? There's always somebody there. So I can see somebody wanting to use that might be pretty frustrated when they're, you know, trying to find an open charger. Say, Sue writes, hello, will Cape residents see any of the electricity produced by the wind farm being installed now, or does it go elsewhere?
Wants to start. I'll start that one. So the grid is a little more complicated than some other networks we think about, and it really all feeds into one big network in New England here. So it's not easy to track an electron coming from a wind turbine and figuring out which house that's going to. So I think of this as all inputs to one big system. So green energy generation really benefits the grid in this area as a whole. So I think whether it's in this specific location or another one where it's generated, it's really about greening the entire grid for the entire New England region.
Yeah, it's difficult to sort of track specific electrons, and I think the question really is, will Cape Cod residents benefit from offshore wind being so close? And our hope is that they will, that some of the electricity supply will become more reliable. And there's also the possibility with some of the potential landing sites for these cables that community host agreements could begin to look at discounted rates for communities that are citing these projects. Mm.
As you mentioned earlier, we've been told we're high because we're at the end of the line. That argument may not hold up once we have the wind farms, right? Because it's right there.
I mean, if I could, it's sort of like the last question we talked about with the charging stations. There's a physics answer to that question, and then there's an economic answer to that question. The physics are the electrons from an electron producing facility go to where the nearest need is. So when the wind is blowing and those offshore farms are built, the electrons that go to Cape Cod will all be used on Cape Cod until there's an excess, and then they'll be exported over the bridge. So I think everybody on the Cape should feel great that in a number of years, all of our electricity needs on the Cape are going to be produced with clean, renewable energy. Now, the economics of that are very different because you hear some of the electricity is being bought in Connecticut, some of it's being bought in other places in Massachusetts. That's all true, but that's the economic model. So it's really important that people think of those as two different models. The electrons will all be renewable, sustainable production from the wind farms, but the economics of it are people are going to be buying that energy elsewhere. Yeah. So I think we should feel good on the Cape that we are doing our part, because we will be a really green community once those wind farms are out doing their thing. Yeah.
Go ahead.
And we certainly shouldn't forget about the other renewable, solar. If you're really interested in making sure that you're doing your part, solar on your roof goes directly to your house. Mm. And certainly there are those that are off grid or feeding into the grid to push it back that way. Whether it be rooftop, whether it be parking lot solar, there's a lot of opportunities there to green the grid in ways that are compatible with our environment.
866-999-4626 is our number for your comments or questions. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Talk about charging infrastructure that has been built on the Cape already. Are there any routes specifically that are better than others? I mean, I think somebody mentioned if you're going to drive from one end of the Cape to Provincetown, you're going to need to know where to stop, right? What's available now?
Well, the short answer is for most vehicles, you actually would not need to stop for that distance. The range we're seeing on modern EVs actually makes this region fairly accessible from an electric vehicle perspective. That being said, we did realize a couple years ago we were behind the curve from other regions, so we made sure that Route 6 was designated as an alternative fuel corridor to bring additional dollars to the region for EV charging, and we have seen additional EV charger installations. We have approximately 7 fast charger locations on the Cape right now, with another 9 coming online in the next year, so we're seeing an uptick there. And then level 2s spread across the region fairly well, roughly 250 plugs to charge in, public level 2 plugs. There are issues with distribution of that across the region. So that's one thing we're really focusing on, is making sure that there's equitable distribution across the region for those access to public charging stations.
I don't know if you know the answer to this, but what about the islands?
The islands are working on this problem as well, certainly even more isolated than us. And we've been talking to our partners on the islands. We've seen a number of installations out there as well. Certainly, the early transition and the early installations have been focused on some of the higher end facilities because they're higher end vehicles. So we've seen a number of hotels out on the islands installing chargers as well. But we want to make sure it's not just for that class of hotel. It's for all hotels. It's not just for that class of vehicle. We're thinking about all users in the long run.
Yeah. And Mindy, a huge shout out to the Cape Cod Regional Transit Authority, because Tom Cahir and his team are in the process now of converting all of their transportation vehicles over to electric. It's going to take a few years. But in answer to part of your question about the islands, Martha's Vineyard, for a number of years, all of their RTA vehicles have been electric, and they've really showed leadership in that. So there's great things happening on the public transit side for electrification.
Yeah, the Vineyard seems to be ahead on a lot of things, right? I mean, we have to look over there, see what they're doing, maybe copy. Al in South Yarmouth writes, "Hi, EVs sound great, but I'm concerned this is a much bigger challenge than it sounds. I recently added solar panels and battery storage to my home. Between limits placed by Eversource as well as the Kings Highway Historical Commission, I could not build a system to handle all my needs. I can only imagine the pushback building charging stations on 6A. How do we manage this?"
Certainly dealing with some of the unique character on the Cape, we want to make sure we do this in a way that's context sensitive. I will say I haven't heard as significant issues with EV chargers in particular compared with solars, just given the visual footprint of them. When you're talking about a home installation, this is often in a garage or attached to a structure, and it's a very small unit. If you didn't know what you're looking for, you wouldn't even see it. So certainly want to be sensitive to those needs, but certainly the visual impact is less, and we haven't heard as significant issues with EV chargers in particular.
All right. Dan, electric planes have arrived. So tell us about their strengths and their limitations.
Well, they haven't arrived, but they're in the planning phase. Mindy, it turns out, and I have an electric vehicle, and so the big challenge with electric vehicles is energy density in the energy source. And, you know, an electric airplane, basically airplanes in general, are built around the energy source and the propulsion. And so you really have to start with a white sheet design, because the energy density required to actually move an airplane a significant distance We don't have the storage technology to do that yet. So what we're looking at for Cape Air, it's perfect because our average flights are maybe 100 to 150 miles. And there is technology now that can actually make that work, even though it's probably 2 or 3 years off as far as being a commercial product. But what we have to really get to in aviation is seeing the improvement in the energy density of the batteries so that we can actually go longer distances. Because while the technology allows us to fly an airplane short distances, commercial the ability to do that and have it be economically viable is a few years off. We really have to see airplanes that can fly 400 or 500 miles with a number of people in them that make it economically viable. And we're not quite there yet. Yeah. So Cape Air has been working on this since 2016. And we've been working with a company called Eviation. People should go online and look at it. Just Google Eviation. And you'll see the airplane we're looking at. It flew a couple of years ago, but it still has to go through the certification at the FAA. It'll be a few more years before you're going to see us transporting passengers, even on the short distances, Hyannis, Nantucket. And then, of course, as we talked earlier, we're going to need infrastructure at the airports to do that.
Yeah.
And the ability to charge that amount of energy storage in a short period of time so that you can utilize the airplane all day requires a huge infrastructure investment at the airports. You're talking about a tremendous amount of amperage to recharge a battery of an airplane in a 20 to 30 minute time period, which, again, you need to turn an airplane that frequently in order for it to be economically viable, because you have to have it in the air 4 to 6 hours a day. Mm-hmm. So the technology is being worked on. The airports are doing their part. The FAA and DOT are doing their part. And the private sector is doing their part. But it's going to take a few years before we actually see our passengers in electric airplanes.
Are the plane batteries manufactured to be lighter than the cars or other vehicles? I mean, are they different? Are they the same kind of batteries?
Right now, they're very similar technology. And, you know, there are safety issues with battery storage because once you're in the air, you can't pull over to the side of the road in case you have a battery fire. So most of the technology around aviation is how to make the batteries safe. But the technology being deployed in aviation right now are very similar to what you're seeing in a Tesla or a Bolt or any of the automobile manufacturers. Mm-hmm.
You talked about the infrastructure that's going to be needed at airports, and we see a lot of smaller regional airports planning for installing this infrastructure, right? So is that pretty much not just here on the Cape, but the other smaller? Are we seeing that on the islands? Are we seeing it in some of the other smaller airports across the state?
You're seeing it all over, and it would be. I would encourage people to look at a site, Beta Technology, BETA. They're a company based in Burlington, Vermont. They actually have a really cool electric airplane that they're developing in a couple of different ways. One would be what's called an eVTOL, which has sort of a helicopter that turns into a conventional airplane after it's in the air, and the other is just a straight conventional airplane. But they're building a charging network of their own. They're following the Tesla model, and they're actually investing in airport infrastructure. Mansfield, for example, has a Beta charging station. They're talking to KD Service at the Gateway Airport here on Cape Cod about installing the technology here. The neat thing that they do is they not only provide airside charging capacity, but they also require that they create some streetside charging capacity as well. So you're going to see charging vehicles and charging airplanes sort of developing at the same time. Mm. But it's got to go way beyond private companies sort of selecting where they want to put their charging infrastructure. We really have to see the DOT and the government start to make serious investment and do the planning required so that we can get to electric in aviation.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, and go ahead, Paul.
Oh, Beta, I just wanted to mention Beta will be at the Big Blue Conference next week. And one of the reasons we wanted to do it at the Gateway Airport is because of their microgrid and their focus on modernizing electric charging over there.
Yeah. I also wonder how the military might set some technology here. I know recently they tested, I don't call it a plane, whatever it was, they tested out it at Joint Base Cape Cod, electric, right? So, I mean, they're working on this as well, the technology.
Well, that was a Beta airplane, actually.
It was,
they tested
okay.
out. Yeah.
You called and it again, an airplane. I thought they said they don't want to call it a plane. I don't remember.
Well, that's because that's the eVTOL model that they tested, the one that does vertical takeoff helicopter and then turns into an airplane. Yeah, they don't want to call it an airplane because they don't want people to think of it in a limited way. But
gotcha.
It's an amazing technology.
Yeah.
You just got to love it.
Yeah. We're talking about next steps in making electric transportation a reality in our region. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about electric transportation this hour with Dan Wolf, founder and board chair of Cape Air, Stephen Tupper, deputy director of the Cape Cod Commission, and Paul Nizwicki, CEO of the Cape Cod Chamber. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Last fall, we had Mark Higgins from the Steamship Authority on the show, and we asked him about the future of electric ferries. At that time, he thought hybrid ferries were more likely than full electric because of the cost associated with charging infrastructure and conversion to a full electric vessel were, of course, steep. But ferries, of course, a big part of the region's transportation. I wonder if any of you have thoughts about the future of electric ferry service.
I think very similar to the conversation we've had about airplanes. The technology is evolving there, and it's good to see the steamship doing their due diligence and understanding what's the best option for them. The investments they're making in the long term are quite significant. So they have to think about what is the best technology when they're investing in a ship that's going to be around for decades. So I know they've done that analysis that you referenced there. And they're also making other investments in their facilities, including solar panels. They are running electric buses as well. So they're thinking about it as an entire ecosystem for their fleet. So I know as technology evolves, they'll continue to evaluate the options for the vessels themselves. We've certainly seen in other areas making the leap to electric ferries, but it's really some specialized analysis given the amount of energy that's needed to move those vessels.
Yeah, they're big. There are electric pleasure boats coming on the market, electric outboard, electric motors. This region has so much pleasure craft. I wonder if any of you have any sense of how quickly we might see that sector move to electric power and if marinas are planning for that transition.
Certainly have a number of modes of transportation to think about here on the Cape. I know we've seen some limited examples of electric propulsion boats. Pleasant Bay Community Boating has a vessel they use for some demonstration and teaching purposes there. I know in terms of pleasure craft, certainly that's something that's coming on the market more recently. And I expect that some of the harbors are going to be thinking about that as well.
You know, we were on vacation last year in New Hampshire on this little lake that doesn't allow motorized boats. And I was like, hey, this guy's got a motor. He had an electric motor. He was fishing on this little lake. I mean, you think about all the opportunities that you could if you went that route, right? I don't know if I've seen any of that here. Have any of you seen any electric boats here?
Well, Mindy is a sailboat guy, and again, this is right, the business star. So, but as a sailboat guy, I will tell you, it's very easy. I mean, I'm converting to a little electric motor, and on a pleasure sailboat, you generally only use them to get to the mooring or off the mooring or when the wind dies or something like that. But there really are very good commercially low power outboard engines that can go on pleasure craft. And this little motor will run for 2 or 3 hours without needing a charge. And the real key is to get a little solar panel. And when the boat's sitting out there at mooring, not doing anything, it can take the charge and trickle charge the battery. So it's actually much more sustainable and usable as we make the conversion. And those are pretty available commercially now, those small motors. So we're getting there.
Okay. As we make the transition to electric transportation, we're going to need a workforce that's trained to maintain and service not just vehicles, but charging infrastructure. Dan, Cape Air has been heavily involved in workforce training. So how are you thinking about making sure you have a workforce ready for electric planes?
Well, we've been we've been collaborating for the last few years developing the aviation technician program at Cape Cod Community College. And I know John Cox and his team over there are really focused on sustainability and climate change issues. And I know that the Cape Cod Community College technician program is going to play a leadership role in training technicians to in aviation, really understand, embrace, and adapt to the new technology. So I'm very, very optimistic that we're going to lead the way as far as that is concerned. But obviously it's a huge opportunity, this transition. You're seeing it already in the offshore wind farm, the thousands of jobs that are being created. And, our key here on Cape Cod, and Paul, you probably want to speak to it, is really, how do we capture that and really optimize it here on the Cape?
Yeah, that's what we've been working with some of the offshore wind companies to develop this pipeline of people that are trained. Part of the Waterworks program is to get people that are in high school, junior high, interested in these sort of blue economy jobs and these jobs on the new electric grid. The Cape Cod Community College now has an associate's degree that they offer in the blue economy. And with their new technology building, there's a lot of possibilities that are happening now and will happen in the future related to workforce training for these new opportunities.
Yeah. It's funny because when you were talking about Cape Cod Community College, the tech schools kind of popped into my head because, I mean, what a great place to start, you know, that. And these kids coming into the tech schools, they're learning the trades that they can afford to buy the houses on the Cape. They don't have a lot of that big college debt, you know, that a lot of other kids do. So definitely something I think we'll be seeing if we aren't already seeing at the tech schools, right?
Yeah, both of the tech schools and the Mass Maritime Academy are sort of heavily invested in workforce training programs related to the industry.
Yeah. See, David wrote, as an avid cyclist, I've been astounded by how many electric bikes have taken off. People who ride them actually get more exercise and use them for errands that would otherwise entail cars. I own an electric car and have solar panels on my house, but we need to envision and work towards making our community safer for smaller individual electric mobility solutions. And then ask Dan, can Cape Air alumni charge for free at the hangar?
Oh, Cape Air alumni. I don't think we're doing that quite yet, but you know what? As a Cape Air alumnus myself, I'm going to advocate for that. But yeah, I mean, we've done, and employers can do a lot with their employees as far as subsidizing or helping them get into electric vehicles and then offer charging opportunities at the workplace. Because again, cars are parked there for a long time. It's a great place to charge up. So, you know, just again, raw with opportunity.
And what about making it safer, because you see these electric bikes everywhere.
Yeah, to speak to e-bikes, certainly we've seen that take off significantly in the last couple of years, both increasing recreational opportunities, getting people out there that maybe had challenges on a normal bicycle. And we're also seeing people using it for commuting as well. In particular, Cape Light Compact has a e-bike rebate program for lower income individuals. They can often use that e-bike in combination with transit to meet some of their needs. But in terms of safety, we want to make sure that these bicycles are exhibiting good behavior on the trails. Bikes or e-bikes can be a problem, but e-bikes can just go a lot more quickly, a lot more easily. So really, it's about good bicycle etiquette with either an electric or a typical bicycle on the paths. And we certainly have infrastructure needs to upgrade as well.
Yeah, Mindy, I was actually in New York City over the weekend. The e-bikes are everywhere in the city, so they'll be here soon.
Yeah, they're already here. And that makes me wonder about the rules. Are the rules on e-bikes the same as a regular bike, or are they more like a car? I mean, you know, because when I grew up, you rode your bike facing traffic, right? But now it's like, no, you're supposed to be like the cars and ride with the traffic flow. So what's the rules for the e-bike?
So generally, an e-bike should be operating like a bicycle. There's been some updates in legislation. There are certain classes that get you beyond a bicycle, and you have to be careful if you're actually a motor vehicle. But for the most part, the e-bikes you're seeing out there should be operating like a bicycle, and they should be operating in a way that's safe and not putting themselves in danger or creating other hazards on the roadway.
Yeah, I'm just thinking how crowded the bike path is in the summer, and that just sounds kind of crazy just to see all that. It's bad enough without the e-bikes. It might get a
little... And Mindy, we ain't there yet. I mean, as an avid biker, I will tell you that there's a safety issue and there's an etiquette issue, and both of those, our understanding of this has to catch up with where the technology has gone. Right. And it's not just bicycles. I mean, you see electric scooters and skateboards and... I mean, it's happening, and these things go fast.
Right.
So, there are huge issues involved, but again, it's all good because it's a more efficient, more environmental friendly way to move around. Yeah. It's good stuff.
We talked about the training that we have at Cape Cod Community College and the tech schools, but right now, who's supporting? Like, who's providing the training for maintaining like these charging stations? Who's doing that currently?
It's a patchwork at this point in terms of that information. I know the Cape Cod RTA brought in some specific trainers. They now have some electric small buses that they're going to be deploying. So they had to bring in some experts to both train their current staff and understand the maintenance needs. And many of the towns have a common vendor, but there are a few different companies working in that space. So I expect that to evolve over time and maybe some efficiencies of some towns working together on that as well.
So if you had the ability to direct the next big steps our region would take toward electric transportation, where would you put the focus and resources? Dan, start with you.
Well, that's a tough one. I think first and foremost, planning. And we are so fortunate because the Cape Cod Commission can work regionally, can work with our towns. We really need to plan what the infrastructure and what the network needs to look like in order to accommodate and facilitate the adaptation that's going on. So I think planning and then working with the state and feds who have the resources to actually fund it are where I would put the priority right now. Paul? So, Steve, it's all on you.
We'll get to Steve last. Paul?
Yeah, I think it's all about the grid modernization because the technologies can develop independently. But if we don't have a grid that can handle it, we're going to face some serious challenges.
Stephen?
Since Dan and Paul covered those so nicely, I'll close with information. I think that anyone who's heard something today about EVs and is curious should dig a little bit deeper. If you're interested on the consumer side, Green Consumer Alliance has a lot of consumer-focused information. If you are interested in running some of the numbers about what makes sense for you, the EPA has a website. You can put in exactly the vehicle, understand where you live, and it'll give you the numbers behind it. So I think that the technology is there for many people to make the leap now. Certainly, if you're driving a truck and towing up every day, maybe it's not for you, but for the vast majority of people, the technology is there. So I'd say research information on reputable sites.
Got a couple minutes left. And Stephen, since we had the listener who talked about not able to put the solar panels to meet their needs, what's your advice for folks who are thinking about solar panels and what they might do? Because it's very confusing and there's a lot of companies out there trying to sell you solar panels.
Yeah, certainly be cautious with anyone who's trying to sell you anything is a good starting point and go to reputable sources. Certainly Cape Light Compact, if you want to think about energy efficiency and other options there, is a good place to start. And then again, some of those state websites where they have that sort of information is good to start. And shop around, get the information and make sure you're comfortable with whoever you're going with. Make sure that they have a good track record.
Anybody else want to add anything to that? All right, Paul, what are you hearing from business owners as we're looking towards this electric transport and visitors? What are they asking? What are you getting most for your question?
Well, we're starting to get more input from visitors who want more locations to charge electric vehicles. A lot of in the hospitality industry, a lot of the larger hotels have already moved in the direction. They see it as a bonus, a way to attract people to their hotels. It's when we get into some of the smaller hotels where it becomes more of a cost issue. This is part of the project that Steve and I are working on together to take a look at. But I think businesses in general are interested. I think they have to be. You know, they want to serve their customers, and more of their customers are driving electric vehicles.
Yep. Dan, you want the final word?
And I will say, Mindy, when I travel, because I've had an electric car now for about 3 years. The first question I ask a hotel when I go online or when I call them, do you have a charging facility? So more and more, this is going to be market driven. Paul's exactly right. People who come here who drive an electric vehicle, it's the first question they're going to ask, whether it be an Airbnb, a small place, or whether it be a big resort.
Yep. I want to remind you, the Big Blue Conference is Tuesday, April 30th and Wednesday, May 1st at the Cape Cod Gateway Airport. We'll have a link with more at our website, capeandislands.org. Dan Wolf, founder and board chair of Cape Air, Stephen Tupper, deputy director of the Cape Cod Commission, and Paul Nizwicki, CEO of the Cape Cod Chamber. Thank you all for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mindy.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.